we have enough people here to start, and we're going to start with the Department of Revenue, the governor's budget for the agency. Dan, are you doing it? Okay. And then, I guess there's two things, the governor's budget for the agency and then the expanded tax compliance initiative. And I'd also like to point out to members, there's a bill in there, 3967. This is a bill that we haven't heard, although I'm not sure if it will get in the tax bill. This is being heard in the tax committee, and this is the one with the, this is the one that has some tax initiatives in it that may affect our budget. Okay, Mr. Solomon, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate the opportunity to share with you the information of the governor's budget recommendations and also to give you the update on the compliance initiative. As you may know, the governor has recommended a reduction in the Department of Revenue budget equal to 3.1% of the non-compliance activity of the department. The governor is rightfully concerned about cuts in revenue that might result in a reduction in revenues collected, reductions in audits, and so on. And so the reduction is 3.1% of the non-compliance portion of the budget. We estimate the non-compliance portion, that is the various support functions, comprise about one-third of the department. The other two-thirds of the department are very direct auditing, collecting functions that are very close to the revenue-producing activity. Now, our employees like to think that everything we do contributes to the collection of revenue, and there's truth in that, Madam Chair. Everything that, you know, if you don't have the HR function doing what it's doing to bring people in that we need, that's going to ultimately have an effect. But we make that distinction, and incidentally, that has grown. There was a time when the support function was about 52%, and the remaining was compliance. It has been over time, because of legislative compliance initiatives, a steady shift toward direct compliance and away from support. So that as we get compliance initiatives, at least in the past, they've been pretty much dedicated to the compliance end of the house.
Mr. Solomon, are you looking for any evidence that there's been an effect on people's happiness or collections or so forth by eliminating the support functions?
Madam Chair, we haven't done a systematic study of that. There's no indication of any widespread discontent. There's always the concern when we start talking about budget cuts, concern on the part of the support folks to feel that they may get short shrift. But we're very open in the department about how we manage these cuts, and we just had a meeting this morning with our employees and shared with them how we intend to manage the cuts that the governor is proposing for us. I can tell you that we are not going to be cutting any compliance positions as a result of the governor's cut. And we're not going to be laying off employees anywhere in the department. We think we can manage it with attrition and the coming wave of retirement. So as we have those, we think we can manage through the cut.
And I know we've had this discussion before, but one of the things that I've been concerned about is that I don't think your department has aggressively approved letting people telecommute and work from home.
Madam
Chair, we might think about some stronger language in this bill.
I'd be happy to provide you some statistics on that. We recently we are actually fairly aggressive about that. The percentage of our employees who commute is, I think, well over 35%.
Oh, okay.
And so we'd be happy to share that memo. I happen to have left it out at my desk when I left.
Okay.
I'll be happy to provide it. The 3.1% cut constitutes a $2.4 million reduction for the Department of Revenue. So we're working to manage that. We think over the next fiscal year, it will result in a reduction of 20 FTEs, again, primarily through, exclusively through attrition and retirement. We are also taking a number of actions. As you know, the governor issued a hiring restriction, and that's going to result in some savings. We are managing that internally. We also have imposed on ourselves a travel restriction We're carefully scrutinizing all requests for travel in the department to make sure that they are very directly related to compliance activities and not merely nice conferences to attend with a much less direct impact on collection. We are encouraging our people when they have management meetings to have them in state-owned buildings in the local area if they can possibly do that. We plan to look at using salary savings leave as another way to manage the cuts. That's a provision that the agencies can use. It's often used during holidays to get some salary savings. We also are going to look at reducing the department's tuition reimbursement program. It's been very rich, and we think we can back off on it a little bit to get a contribution towards the goal of the $2.4 million.
Do you think that might have any effect on employee retention or hiring?
We're going to have to watch that very closely, Madam Chair. We know that it's a very popular program, and we have a lot of young people who will take advantage of it, have been taking advantage of it.
Totally at your discretion, though, isn't it? When someone asks, it's totally at your discretion.
Yes, it is. Okay. Yes, and we're not eliminating it. We're simply adjusting the maximum dollar amount downward to save a little money.
Right. Mr. Salmoni, I've always had this problem about hiring freezes, is that it means we kind of structure our employment by how people who leave. And has that caused you any problems? Have you seen any? Is there anyone who's left that you really felt that you should rehire? You should rehire that position, or do you have enough flexibility?
There's not been a pronounced pattern there. The freeze, we really haven't had a real hard freeze recently. The governor's hiring freeze is an advisory. It gives us a lot of flexibility to manage how we do those cuts. We have identified certain classes of positions in the department that we will automatically approve the filling of vacancies, and in other areas we will require that directors and supervisors get specific authority to fill vacancies. So we're being very deliberate about it to make sure that we do the right thing in terms of the collection of revenue. So, and Madam Chair, that's pretty much a short summary of how we think we're going to manage through the governor's proposed reduction. And we think we can do it without any impact on the compliance end of the House. And as you know, we have a very ambitious compliance initiative underway, and I'll be soon reporting to you about that.
Okay. And you sort of said, I didn't quite, are there numbers associated with the amount of people that are rented space as opposed to state-owned space?
I don't have the counts with me. We do have some rented space, obviously, in Ely and most recently in Eagan.
Are you totally out of rented space in St. Paul?
We are totally, well, in terms of our building, the Stassen building, it is totally full.
Okay.
And that has not been the case, as you know, in recent years. We had lots of empty space. Mm. The Office of Administrative Hearings has moved into our building. It's a great place for them to be. And so now, because of the lack of vacancy in our building, when we get new compliance initiatives, it automatically means we're going to have to look for private rental space. And that will be part of the reason why we will say to you and are saying to you that any future compliance initiative we would probably have a lower expected ROI, rate of return, on the appropriation, simply because we have a new hole in the bucket that we'll have to siphon money off to pay for rented space in private buildings, which we didn't have to do in the past.
Well, what if we gave you new compliance initiatives and said you to fill them all by reorganizing space by using more telecommuting?
Well, we'd certainly be open to looking at that. We'd have to study that carefully because there are certain synergies between different types of people and different types of positions that might make telecommuting a little more difficult when it comes to collecting taxes. In theory, with the technology we have nowadays, one would expect we could do more telecommuting, even more than we currently are doing. So we certainly could look at that.
You think if you had someone whose identity was so tied in with telecommuting that they wouldn't even need a permanent desk, you could have a couple of people sharing desks?
I think that's increasingly becoming more common.
I was listening to Mr. Hilty tell us about peak oil, so I'm just following his instructions to wean people off driving. So, okay.
Madam Speaker,
no.
I don't know about any information that anybody else doesn't. Madam Chair, could you tell us a little bit more about the tuition reimbursement program? The reason I ask is that I have heard from a number of sources about the challenge we have with the number of CPAs coming through the system, how quickly they get trained in by state government. You can't keep up with their with the higher salary offerings in the market, and that as a result, we're training them and sending them out to the private sector. It seems to me that you are also paying for them to build their qualifications through higher education or other kinds of further education without a link to the amount of time they need to stay at the department afterwards. We may just be exacerbating that. Is there? Can you just tell us more about it?
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, you raised a good question. It's something we need to be concerned about. We feel we need to do everything we can to not only attract, but to retain, more importantly, to retain people with accounting skills and business skills. And one of the things that is very attractive in doing that is this tuition reimbursement. I can describe it in a minute. But I will back up and say that historically we've had a tremendous problem keeping people. We bring them in and we'd have them for about a year or two, and usually in that second year we would lose a tremendous percentage, a third or more, of our new hires. And so we'd start all over and bring more people in. And you're right that we were running a little school of tax accounting for these young people. Now we went to the Department of Employee Relations and separately negotiated a memo of understanding to provide a little more quicker progression of these people through the higher through the various steps in the pay range so that they could get rewarded more quickly and hopefully have them stay a little longer. That has worked to some extent. It has moved the two-year crisis period to more like the four-year crisis period. So we've gotten an extra couple of years out of that memo of understanding, and we continue to have that renewed with the Department of Employee Relations. With regard to the tuition reimbursement, it's my understanding that various departments have their own policies about this, and it's funded from department funds. And I don't have all the history of our tuition reimbursement plan, but currently it's a $6,000 maximum. Employees have to have worked long enough to clear their probationary period, and then if they enroll in a qualified program, we stand ready to reimburse them up to $6,000. Now we're reducing that amount to $5,000 as part of our managing of this current budget reduction. But that is a very, very valuable tool in attracting people to come to the department.
And Madam Chair, is there any requirement about how long they need to stay with the department after they've received that benefit? I know frequently in the private sector they will pay for advanced degrees or other kinds of things that usually then on the hook to stay there for two or three years or whatever it is after you've gone through the program, and if not, then you have to reimburse the employer for that expense. Do you have anything like that?
Madam Chair, Representative, we do not have that. We've been reluctant to do that, and I'm not sure we'd have the authority given the state. We'd have to look into whether the state personnel system would allow us to do that. But I understand the concern you're raising, and it's one that it's probably worth looking into.
It's probably just not enough money to make it worthwhile. It's not like you're paying for an MBA or something like that with that amount of money.
Well, I guess the other thing that might be interesting just to look at the statistics, just look at the history of people who have taken it and how long they've stayed after they've taken it.
Madam Chair, if there are no other questions on the budget cuts, I would move on to talk
tax
about
compliance.
The compliance report.
Right. We'd like to.
And I do have a handout for the members. I know you get inundated with mail, and so you may not have recognized that on March 1st, you should have all received a report on a status of our compliance initiative. We're required by law to give the members a report. That came up here on March 1st. And this little short handout is a synopsis of what you'll find in that report. I'm going to focus only on the big numbers and remind you of what it was that was appropriated last session and where we are in the process. If you'll look on, everybody has a copy. If you look at the second slide on the first page, you'll see the yellow row on the bottom is the has the data for the current compliance initiative. Last session we received $20.5 million under the appropriations column there, third column. That was appropriated to us for a promised return of $102.4 million of additional revenue. I have to tell you, and I think many of you remember, that we were very reluctant to agree to that compliance initiative. It's one of the most ambitious we've ever undertaken. Now, at the same time, we've had several of these over our history, and you'll see a little bit of our history there. In fact, all of our history there in terms of compliance initiatives. We have had very good rates of return on dollars given to us for compliance initiatives. But we've always felt that as you do more of this, you're likely to hit diminishing returns. I'm an economist by training, and that's one of the few lessons I remember from grad school, is that elsewhere, if you keep applying factors to the process, you ultimately get diminishing returns. It's inevitable. But I'll have to say that so far we haven't seen that in any dramatic way, and we're not sure why that is, but we're mindful of the fact that we are, at any point in terms of future initiatives, we could see a significant change. Well, if you look at the chart, of course, the promised rate of return was 5 to 1, and currently we've expended $3.1 million and have collected $23.2 million, which is a very good rate of return. It's shown there on the right as 7.4 to 1. Now, we are very confident, very sure that that number is going to drop to something closer to 5 to 1 before we're done. This is an early stage of a compliance initiative where this is typical that we have higher rates of return.
I would think the rate of return would go back at the later stages as you got better at it. Why is the rate of return higher at the early stages?
I think I can't give you a real precise answer. I think it all has to do with the timing. We have, obviously, we incur expenses on the front end. So that would make you think it would be just the opposite, that we would have a lot of expenses and less revenue, so we'd have a lower rate of return. I wish my financial services director was with me. He's boarding a plane to Arizona, and I think he has a good answer to your question, but I'll have to get back to you with that.
Yes. Representative Portman?
I suspect it's the low-hanging fruit. There's some people, if you contact them right away, they get into compliance, and other people are more recalcitrant, and over
The problem is, I don't see how when you start the compliance initiative, you know, identify the low-hanging fruit. I don't see how you...
But I think the point is that in any given initiative, when you start out, you sort of try to go for the low-hanging fruit, and you pick that off, and eventually it gets harder and harder to do this. That would also explain, in terms of the big scheme of things, that these continual initiatives, you might expect the rate of return to fall as well, because we're using all the tricks in the book, and we're using the better technology, and you just ultimately get to the point where it's just much more difficult to get that incremental dollar of compliance revenue.
For the completed, you know, again, I think I'd agree with that more if you were just starting it. So we really had these continuing, accelerating expenses. So some of the things that we followed through a whole biennium, like the one that we started with 2003, what did you discover in terms of patterns on that?
In terms of
Patterns of how collections went.
I think it's my understanding that all of these initiatives had higher rates of return in their early stages than they did in their later stages. And with the current one, my director of finances, who's very familiar with how these things work, is very confident that the 7.4 is going to probably drop closer to the promised 5 to 1. Now, when this was debated last session, we were very reluctant to go to the level that was appropriated, the 20.5 and the 100, revenue of 102.4. That was about two times what the governor had recommended at the time. And we were very concerned about overcommitting. We always are when we make these commitments. We want to be sure that we don't create a budget problem by promising revenue to you if we can't deliver. And so far, it's been a pretty good experience. In the next chart, it shows more just different views of our history. You'll see on the top of page 2 the fact that we've had significant success in raising more revenue than promised. In the 2002-03, it was 62% more than it promised, and then in the 2004-05, 54%, 2006-07, 26%, and as of today, we are still, it's too early to say how we're going to come out, but we are hopeful that we will meet the goal that was that we promised. The chart on the bottom of that page just shows right now where the ROI is, comparing the various compliance initiatives. And 7.4, we expect that green dot to drop down to where the 5.0 point is there. On page 3, in terms of money collected, I mentioned the $23.2 million so far collected. That's through December 31. There might be a slightly updated data in the report we sent up here on March 1st. $13.9 million was received from identifying non-filers and increasing the number of audits of individuals and businesses, and $9.3 million collected from delinquent taxes from our accounts receivable system. We've resolved 9,600 non-compliant individual income tax cases in the short period that we've worked on this compliance initiative, 400 non-compliance case sales and use tax cases, and 316 non-compliant corporate tax payers. I think the most important message here is that we think we're on track, and I stress think, we're not totally 100% confident, but we think we're on track to meet the goal of $102.4 million in spite of our reservations last year. But we are nervous about it for several reasons. I note in the bottom of page 3, this current initiative was one that required us to hire 136 new auditors and collectors. This is where the compliance money goes. It's for people, and they're usually auditors or collectors. And it just takes a long time to hire 136 good people. And that's a huge amount that we have to sort of get as many of those people hired as possible to really start making progress and seeing the return on the investment. I mentioned earlier the shortage of office space. We will now have to leave space for any future compliance initiatives. And I'm not here, Madam Chair, to suggest that we should do a future compliance initiative. We will continue to be very skeptical and very defensive because we want to be cautious about this and make sure that we don't overcommit. And we continue to watch the rapid turnover in our positions in accounting. As I mentioned, we have a two-year problem. Now we have a four-year problem. We have to watch that to see how that plays out. We may have to take some other actions to try to get folks to stick around a little longer. So it's a work in progress. We think we're on target, and hopefully we'll be able to meet the goal.
Questions? Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just wondering how many of the 136 you were able to hire, if you know.
I don't know. I think we're getting close to the end. We've had what we do is have large job fairs in the lobby of our revenue building, and we get pretty good turnout. We have HR people there to do interviews right on the premises and make offers. So it's a very smooth process, and I know we're not done, but we're getting close.
I still have problems that when I read the current initiative, I read that the current initiative is risky. And one of the things is because of the time lag in hiring and training. But when you look at what's happening, your return on investment is higher than we'd expect with the expenditures. So you think that would show a lag in the return on investment at this time.
Then I'm sure that would take some analysis. It could be that the low-hanging fruit phenomenon that was brought up overwhelms the fact that you've got all this additional personnel costs on the front end. We'd have to sort of dissect that and try to figure out what's really going on there. Because the numbers are going to change very rapidly and very soon, we weren't anxious to go through that kind of analysis, but I can certainly take a look at it and see if I can give you any feel for what's really going on there.
Okay, any other questions? Representative Tulsi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Salamone, I guess what I ask is this, what's the recidivism rate? If you catch up with the non-compliers, are they converted to the straight and narrow forever, or have you kept track of how that works?
Madam Chair, I don't know whether we systematically track that. I wish our collections people, maybe there's someone here from collections. I know some of our staff are here. I don't know what the rate is. We'd like to think it's, that once we get them, they're compliant forever, and that's probably not true. But I would guess it's a very small percentage who lapsed back. I doubt that it's a very large number. Because often these are costly propositions for some of these folks, the penalties and interest. And again, I certainly can look into that and get you some feel for that.
Well, Madam Chair, I would hope that that would be the case, that there weren't many relapses, in which case, unless we assume that there's just an unlimited number of non-compliers out there, or they're moving into the state at some great rate, we think at some point we would be reducing the number. I think that would actually be the goal. It's hard to look at this initiative as something that would be an ongoing source of revenue or an increasing source of revenue.
Yeah, I'm sure I would agree with that. That one would expect that there'd be some learning here, and we would over time have generally a more compliant set of taxpayers. Of course, you always have new people coming into the system who've never filed, who are not aware of their tax filing obligations. We'll always have that sort of introduction class of taxpayers who may need a little help. And that's a challenge for our department, to make sure they get the material they need to understand their obligations. A lot of people are turned off about paying taxes and turned off about filling out the form. We wish more people would warm up to electronic filing, although I have to say we are one of the best states in the country in terms of the percentage of people who electronically file. And it's gone up. This year we're noticing a big uptick, so well over 80%. So, and because of that, we're able to provide most of those people with 2 or 3 day refunds, which is getting their attention. So we're happy about that.
Okay. The problem is the history shows that we've continually underestimated what you can do.
I believe that you're correct.
Yeah, but we're random. Every once in a while we'd overestimate.
But I have a feeling as soon as we decide to roll the dice and become more optimistic about what we can do, it's then that we will have our first problem in terms of maybe unmet expectations. I was worried about that.
Maybe we should worry about it when we hit it. Representative
just don't punish them for exceeding expectations.
No, we reward them. Isn't that what you're supposed to do with little children? As soon as they do things right, you raise the expectations. So if they go, isn't that how you train horses and all sorts of people? Okay. Any, I guess, Mr. Salamone, we'd also like you to, because this is going to be crucial to the budget balancing issue, we'd like you to explain House File 3967 to us, which is the data matching project.
Medicare,
we need to give you...
I don't know if there's anyone here from revenue. We were going to have some folks up here anticipating that question. I'm not the expert on that. I can tell you that what we're asking for is the ability to have the banking community help us match our debt against their depositors, and I understand a number of other states do that, and and it would not be without, as I understand it, without some compensation to the banks in terms of fees. So it's something that's worth looking at. We think it's worth looking at, and could raise as much as, by estimates of other states, as much as $10 million. And so beyond that, I know there's a lot more detail you probably want to know, but we'd have to probably get someone in here who's a little more into it than I am.
Yeah. Representative Lindquist?
We're going to hear from more testifiers on
this. There are. I don't know quite what to do. There are a bunch of testifiers on it. I think they're kind of all and have doubts about it. And I almost would like to hear someone tell us why the program should work before we hear why it shouldn't work. But if they hear, maybe you can hear why it shouldn't work, and then we'll hope to get someone who can. So let's...
Madam Chair, it could be by the time the hearing is over, we'll have some revenue folks out here.
Okay. Yes. Okay. Ms. Cook? Okay. I understand, Ms. Cook, that you're the one who coordinated the public testimony on this, or helped us with that.
Yes, I did. Okay. For the record, my name is Judy Cook with Cook Hill Derived Associates, representing the Minnesota Bankers Association today. And there's also a couple other people here who have comments, and we will work very hard not to overlap our comments. I know it's a little bit of a disadvantage for all of you because you've not had the opportunity to hear from the department about the bill, but basically what they're looking at is a financial data match program whereby, as Mr. Salamone said, they would provide financial institutions on a quarterly basis with their list of folks who have tax liens, which my understanding is about $19,000 a quarter, I believe, and then the banks would check that against their customer database. And they have based that, from what I understand and what they've testified in other committees, on the Child Support Data Match Program, which is a federal program, and so there are a number of differences and distinctions that that you may want to know about. First of all, as a federal program, people really can't move their assets and get away from having to pay. So in a state-run program, people obviously could move their assets outside the state or to an Internet account. And then the department would not have the ability to attach those funds. There's also a federal program, actually. So any financial institution who operates in multiple states actually goes through a federal clearinghouse. And so it is not on a state-by-state basis. We have some due process issues. My understanding is that there's a judgment involved in a child support claim, and yet this is a lien, and so we're trying to understand that a little bit. I know that Indiana passed it last year, and they're still working on it. Kentucky passed it a couple years ago. There was a court challenge, and I think they repassed it. But I don't think it's fair to suggest that it is operating in a couple of states, but we understand there are some issues. There are also some jurisdictional questions. There's also a lot of cost to financial institutions when you do a state-specific program, and I think someone else will talk about that. I think it's important to note that my understanding is in the other states, at least in Kentucky and Indiana, I believe it's their Department of Revenue who actually manages their Child Support Data Match Program, whereas here it's our Department of Human Services, so that's another distinction. We've heard some liability concerns compared to the federal law. We think there's some privacy issues potentially. And I think the discussion you previously had is interesting. We think there actually would be diminishing returns to the state because once people are aware of this, they will move their funds. And so we are concerned that we're going to go to a lot of cost to run this program for a state-specific program where people can move their assets, as I said, which is very different from the federal Child Support Data Match Program where they can't hide similarly. So I'll be happy to answer any questions if anybody has them, but perhaps you'd like to hear from the other testifiers.
I think that would probably be good if we did that, and then we'll go back to go to questions. Yes?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Mara Humphrey, I'm the Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the Minnesota Credit Union Network, and I'm going to echo some of Judy's concerns but don't want to overlap, but we do have significant concerns about Department of Revenue's data match proposal. Specifically, one of our concerns is the ability of credit unions to comply with this, with the technical requirements, especially the ability of some of our smaller credit unions. Under the Child Support Data Match, Financial institutions are able to provide the data through electronic media or by mailing, delivering, or faxing the information. And this proposal requires financial institutions to transmit it in encrypted form by secure electronic means. And we have been in communications with the department. I appreciate their willingness to work with us on this, but we do have concerns about the ability to comply with this proposal. We also have some broader concerns regarding liability, the financial institution's liability handling this personal sensitive financial information. Also have a concern about the cost that this is going to be for credit unions to implement this. Because it's a state-specific program, not a nationwide program, one mid-sized credit union who talked to their data processor estimated the cost to set up the software to run this at around $5,000, an additional couple hundred dollars every time that they run the match, because they're going to have to write a specific set of software for Minnesota because it's not nationwide like the child support information. So we do have some concerns about this, about the liability that it's going to give us and some of the privacy concerns. So, Madam Chair, thank you. I will turn it over to Mr. Skilberg. Okay. Mr. Skilberg.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. My name is David Skilbred, Vice President of Government Relations for the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota, an association of about 300 privately held, community-focused banks statewide. The previous comments are comments that we share right on down the line. I think the difference, when I first heard about this program and the fact that it was modeled after an existing program, I thought, well, that should be pretty easy. But the more we look into it, the more concerns we have. The ones that were addressed previously are right on the mark. The differences in programs from a federal program to a state program, the difference in options that are currently available through the federal program versus the difference in options presented by this program, the costs are certainly a concern. We appreciate the department's willingness to try to compensate the institutions for providing this material, but it's not going to be a net no cost to these members. And so with that, members, I'll just be very short and very sweet here. So that concludes my testimony. Thank you.
Madam President, okay. We do appreciate the department has, you know, been talking to us about it, but again, there are still concerns. I guess the other point I would mention, since the department didn't have the opportunity, they have budgeted, my understanding, is about $240,000 annually for reimbursement at $150 a quarter per financial institution. So I think if you do the math, not my strong suit, so we're looking at about 400, roughly around 415, 420 are the number of banks that actually could be reimbursed, financial institutions that could be reimbursed each quarter. And I think it's also important to note it includes insurance companies and safe deposits and credit union banks. So it's a broad range of financial institutions, and so there really, we believe, is inadequate reimbursement in the bill.
Okay. One of the things, when you talked about the moving of assets, this is a debt, so it's owed, so it's not. So it seems to me if you just trace the people who move your assets, it might be a good way of finding them.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure what the department does in terms of compliance.
Okay.
Once they find out the information, I guess the point is that we run the information, and if we have a match, then they go through the formal process of filing the actual lien, which my understanding is a one-time deal, and so they file a lien, and if the money's still there from when we first looked, then I guess they get it, unless it's exempt funds. And so in that regard, I think the point was the difference between the federal and the state program. Federally, you can't move to another financial institution because they'll find you, and in the state, they can't reach beyond those financial institutions operating in Minnesota.
For the financial, get it from the but you still get it from the person.
Madam Chair, my understanding, and I know we've got a lot of lawyers looking at this from a jurisdictional perspective, the financial institutions can only report on those individuals who reside in Minnesota because of the reach in terms of liability and data privacy and those kinds of things. So those are things we're trying to sort through right now.
Madam Chair, Ms. Cook, and the other testifiers, basically, if I hear your testimony as a whole, it sounds like the amount of the appropriation may be inadequate to cover the actual cost. But if the somewhat conservative revenue department thinks that they can make a whole lot more, then presumably we could take care of that by appropriating a bit more money to cover more of the cost, and they should be making plenty more than that back. And so that seems like that could be dealt with pretty straightforwardly based on projections of what they think they could gain. Liability and privacy, this would have to be in compliance with the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act and all the other kinds of restrictions, and maybe the bill needs to be tweaked there, but that's also something that could be pretty worked through pretty straightforwardly. And aside from that, you're, I guess, suggesting that maybe it may not be effective because people can move assets, but I'm guessing that there'll be a lack of information among people who don't pay their taxes that they can simply shelter those assets by moving them to an out-of-state bank. That seems like, you know, maybe the most sophisticated people trying to avoid paying taxes might do that, but I'm guessing a lot of people aren't that sophisticated who are doing this. So it doesn't sound like you're sort of principally opposed to this, but that the bill needs to be perhaps worked through in some of its details to get to a point where you'd be okay with it. Is that accurate?
Madam Chair and Representative, we're trying our best to work with the department to iron out the wrinkles. Those are options that might be available to come to a place in time where everyone would feel comfortable about that. I'm not sure that we could do that or we're there yet, though. I'll add one more point, though, that I did not mention. The effective date for this, I believe, is July 1, 2008. I'm not sure if that means that that would be the first point at which names would be encrypted and sent to financial institutions, or if it would be sometime after that. But I think that that's a very aggressive date for banks to change their software programs and be ready to do the program by that time. We've investigated this a little bit on our end, and the businesses that we would hire to help us make these software upgrade changes are telling us that you would need 90 days to 180 days to get a new package written and to get a new software program implemented. And I forget how many banks there are exactly, but there's 452 or so in Minnesota. How many credit unions?
162 credit unions.
162 credit unions. So you would have to have a program person to do that at each of those institutions, not to mention the insurance companies, so that they would be ready. And because it is a state-specific program as opposed to a national program, those programs would take some time to be developed.
Madam Chair, Representative, okay. I think from the Minnesota Bankers Association perspective, you are right, a lot of those details could be worked out. But again, the issue, particularly for banks who operate in multi-states, to have state-by-state processes that all differ as opposed to something that is a federal program, such as the Child Support Data Match, certainly is not preferable. Could the details be worked out? I think they probably could, but it's not preferable to have state-by-state approaches to things like that.
Okay, well, obviously what we need to do with this, first of all, we should probably trace when this bill is being heard in the pastures and told, and see if members of this committee can look at that. We need to get the people in revenue who are in charge of this to explain why and I'm sure that you guys will come back when they're here too to answer those questions. We also clearly need to look at the history in other states and see how is it rolled out in other states. And is there any, you know, there's things like a Uniform Laws Commission, anything like that. Are they, would seem that this would be a really good issue for them to be looking at. Do you know if there's any effort at looking at this in the, in any of the National Associations of Financial Officers or Revenue Commissioners or CSG or...
Madam Chair, I don't know if any of those organizations are doing that. What I can tell you, though, is we've been in contact with bankers from Indiana, which is one of the states who have done that. And after several emails with them, it appears to me as if they did not base their law on such a uniform practice, but rather developed their own and then amended it several times to get to where they are, and as Ms. Cook said, are still trying to work with it in order to make it work now that it went into effect about last week.
And I'm sure we'll get answers. You can
okay.
To work on it with the department and really appreciate the opportunity to give you this information.
Okay, and we'll do a better job of getting the people from Revenue here to present it. I actually thought, I guess, well, sometimes what I understand about our process is not much better than what anyone else does. So. Okay, let's go to try and go to the bills, to the bills in order. House file 3770, Winthrop.
Madam Chair, I would move that House File 3770 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Finance.
Okay.
And I do have a DE1 amendment I'd like to offer as well. Put that in bill in shape. It should be in front of you.
Okay, Representative Winkle moves the DE1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passes. The bill is now in the form in which you wish it.
Madam Chair, members, the DE1 amendment is take the original version of the bill, which was developed with Senator Rath, and add additional language provided by the Office of Enterprise Technology to, I think, strengthen the bill and clarify it. So we've been working with OET and others. And essentially what the bill does is to require more of a centralized review process of all major IT projects in state government to make sure that they are financed correctly, that they are consistent with state policy, and that we're getting the most that we can out of the money that we're spending in IT infrastructure and systems.
Representative Wiggler, have we moved up the projected costs and so forth from the existing statute in terms of, I know that no, we do the progress, we need to have an independent audit. There was some level of project that we needed to have an independent review as the project was being implemented, I thought.
Madam Chair, the numbers were provided by OET about when those audits would take place, and I reduced them to, I guess, increase their workload potentially. And I think they had $2 million and $1 million, and I changed it to $1,500,000. But I don't know how that varies from the original statute.
Mm-hmm. Where's the
$500,000? In the DE1 amendment, it is, it's $1 and $5 million.
Yes.
$1 million and $5
million. Okay. All right.
Just zeros, Madam Chair.
I know. Anyone have any questions about this? Is there anyone from John, do you want to say something about this? Yes.
Madam Chair and members, my name is John Lalick from the Office of Enterprise Technology. We've been working with Representative Winkler and with Senator Rest on this. Part of the issue is in our processing of requests for projects and reports on projects, we've adopted a three-pronged strategy. One is to create a set of best practices and project management tools that people can use to do a good job of project management. Secondly, we've tried to invest in a review process for many of the major projects generally, and there are hundreds of projects going on simultaneously in state government in the IT area, but some of them are more likely to be risky than others. Very large projects that have a long span for development that involve multiple jurisdictions, state and federal, for example, or multiple agencies, there are many more opportunities for those projects to have problems. So we tend to focus on those, but we need information from all the others so we can try to identify when a project requires our third step of involvement, which is intervention, either in terms of shutting a project down, which is the situation, or more likely to get it back on track. And the pressure on us is that we don't have a lot of information. The law requires us to analyze these. It doesn't require anybody else to give us the information. Mm-hmm. So it's largely a situation that many of the agencies that have a history of doing this stuff really well are more than willing to give us the information. Some of the other agencies that are a little more reluctant to share information on a timely basis with us are sometimes the ones we want to really work with more closely. What this does is bring our current practice, which focuses right now, Representative Kahn, on a risk assessment mm-hmm. being done before a project is involved in external risk assessment if it's above a certain price. But beyond doing the risk assessment, the law is unclear about what kind of information we have to get. And our goal is to get information that any competent project manager is going to have for their project. We're not adding to their workload. We're not expecting any information they wouldn't already have, but to have that sent to us. And that's reported to you in a portfolio report that we do at the beginning of every budget session. We've done it every year since once. We did it 2 years ago for the first time, and we'll be doing it again next year.
Mm-hmm.
And this would simply be a way to get that information to you about all the projects that are underway in state government above a certain threshold.
Madam Chair, if I could just add a couple other points.
Included
also in the bill is the requirement that all of the major IT projects that are being requested in the budget process actually come to one place at one time instead of it being divided up. And overall, this bill, I think, should be seen together with the report that OET developed on potential funding sources and some other projects that they're working on as an effort to really make sure that we're getting the best use of the dollars we can, and that when they make future budget requests, that we also have a return on investment aspect of the request. And so this is kind of, I think, helping to put the house in order as we look at the additional funding sources and funding alternatives that we, I think, will be putting forward next year.
Okay. Our Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Winkler, I just want to thank you for putting this together. I think it's a good start for us. I'm just curious, though, do you feel that the $1 million and the $5 million threshold is low enough? I mean, should we be going below that? I mean, what are your thoughts?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, I think that Mr. Lally's grimace when you asked the question relates to the fact that if they went any lower, they would be asking for more money to be able to do it, because I think of the number of projects that would fall below that threshold would increase their workload considerably. And as you mentioned, the riskiest ones are the more expensive. And it's, you know, frankly, the $1 million level for a state agency isn't that expensive for the kinds of things they do, especially when we're talking about the Department of Public Safety has a $50 to $60 million mainframe computer project. Department of Finance, I think, is a $40 million system change. So tens of millions of dollars are the really big ones. This range is kind of, middle of the road.
Okay. All right, thank you.
And I might, Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, point out that Representative Winkler has in the amendment language calling for an independent assessment on the larger projects, and that is a way basically to leverage our limited resources. I have only four project managers to deal with all 70 state agencies and several hundred projects. For the really big ones, we need to have somebody looking at that, but I just don't have the horsepower within my own organization to do that. This allows them to leverage it by getting a private contractor or another agency to step in and do that independent viewpoint on an annual basis.
Okay. You know, at one point, for really big project. I guess I'm interested in the section that talks about the independent audit. Is that section on the independent, does that mean someone that's in your agency, but just independent of the project?
Madam Chair, the way it's defined in the amendment is it has to be somebody outside the sponsoring agency.
Okay.
But ownership of a systems development project rests with the host agency, not with OET. We don't manage projects, we just provide the oversight. So it would have to go out, for example, Revenue Department system, they would go to somebody outside the Department of Revenue to provide that independent oversight, and we would have approval over whoever individual or entity they would select for that.
That's not... Is it someone outside of state government, or would it usually be someone inside?
Madam Chair, it could be somebody outside, or it could be somebody inside. Our concern is that we get somebody who's qualified to do that kind of assessment. This is not something that everybody from Joe's Barber College and System House can do.
Okay. Who pays for that independent audit? Is it deducted from the cost of the project, and how much does this typical audit cost?
Madam Chair, our plan would be that as part of the budgeting for the system, they would include this cost as a budget. The cost depends, I hate to say this, but the cost depends on the complexity of the scale of the system. Typically, somebody doing it on a full-time basis, it would be $75,000 to $100,000. We're toning that down to an annual review where they would be examining, for example, the project plan, the deliverables, the milestones, are they meeting them? Are they within budget? Are they on schedule? Those are less than a full-time project manager would do, but the cost is accordingly a lot less.
Okay. And, you know, at one point, we had when we had a bunch of projects that were in really bad trouble, I'm thinking of the health ones, thinking of even pre-CRIMNET era and so forth. One of the things that we said was that the state does really big projects very seldom, and we're almost at the mercy of the people who are doing them for us, and that there existed in the outside world people. What we ought to do in these things is we ought to hire somebody who's just on our side, who doesn't want to cover things over for the vendor and so forth, and has had experience overseeing these really big projects in other states. Is this something that we still talk about or not?
Madam Chair,
there was a legislative audit report, I recall, and we did hire, I forget which was the system that was in tremendous trouble, but we did hire an outside auditing firm.
Madam Chair, we call those owner's reps. And the owner is the state in that case, that we look to them to look out for the state's interest in this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite a common concept in major systems development. The reason why projects fail rarely have anything to do with technology and often have nothing to do with project management. They usually have to do with the management and the ability to define what you want to do and control your environment and changes and that sort of thing. So any of these firms that would come in, we're not asking them to take over management of the project, which is, I think, the case, if I remember my history. They brought somebody in essentially to replace the management of that project, and I can't remember which one it is either, except it was pretty dramatic. This is not what we're looking for here. These are not rescue, it's reporting.
Okay. Well, looks like a good idea. Question is, I'm not sure if it goes far enough, but we'll... And this goes on to finance, doing like we sent in.
That's my understanding, Madam Chair.
Yes. Okay. Any further discussion on the Winkler motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passed. Okay, 3723, which is the bill of mine, which is part of the follow-up parts of the 35W program. And this is one of the things that kind of a little shifting of money doing to the construction of the bridge. And I guess this must be, Mr. Rice here is the attorney for the Minneapolis Park Board. And I think we're going to do two things with this bill. We're going to pass it on, but we also may roll it into our omnibus bill, depending on what's happening elsewhere in the area. So I guess I'll move that House File 3723 be recommended to pass on to Finance. And I'll ask Mr. Rice to explain what's happened in it. Mr. Rice.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Brian Rice. I'm the attorney for the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board. And your committee assistant passed around a green sheet, two pages stapled together that maybe I'll refer to. This legislation, House File 3723, comes before this committee. It's a result of the I-35W collapse. I'm glad to see Representative Winkler here. I know he knows probably as much about this as any member of the body. When the I-35W bridge collapsed, it obviously necessitated a reconstruction of the project. MnDOT immediately requested and received consent from the Park Board to not only reconstruct, but they used Park Board land at Bohemian Flats to deposit the remains of the bridge to do the forensic analysis as well as access to the property. The Park Board had accumulated a fair amount of property in this area through grants from the Metropolitan Parks and Open System, through bonding from this legislature to develop the Central Riverfront Regional Park. In deciding to reconstruct the bridge, the footprint for the bridge expanded, and on the first page you will see generally this direction is north to downstream or to the east of the bridge. You'll see a shaded area. They've expanded the footprint of the bridge, and under the Federal Highway Administration rules, MnDOT needs to own and fee title the real estate for all the land over which an interstate travels. So MnDOT commenced the condemnation proceeding against the Park Board to take fee title interest to this land, which is currently held by the Park Board, and that's to the east of the...
One question of that. Is this a new MnDOT ruling? Do they already own the land that's under the old bridge?
They do.
So it's just the expansion.
Right, it's just the expansion. They decided to expand the footprint, and then there are certain tolerances, if you will, in terms of what they need to maintain in terms of the right-of-way, like any other roadway that they'd have, that MnDOT has a footprint. And then the second page shows a lesser area to the west of the bridge that... that they're also taking land upstream of the bridge through a condemnation action against Minnegasco, but that the Park Board had a permanent easement over for parkland. So, in essence, MnDOT is going to need additional land to do the reconstruction of the bridge because of widening the bridge and new construction standards that happened from the 1960s to the 21st century. I want to be clear, the Park Board is not contesting the condemnation. In fact, our superintendent immediately signed a 4F waiver under the Volpe decision. The Park Board could have, raised objections. There's a federal law that doesn't allow interstates to go through parkland unless you go through EIS stuff. I mean, it's clearly a tragedy, clearly a huge public need to get this bridge back up and running for the whole state. But MnDOT did then commence a condemnation action and to take this land. Well, as we worked through it, and this is getting us to the bill, we worked for a long time to reclaim the riverfront. We've done that through large part through help of Madam Chair yourself, members of the legislature. But now approximately, I believe it's about 2 acres of land is going to be taken out. It can't be used for park purposes. That will be used for transportation purposes. And there's a provision in law that requires, but this was financed with state bond proceeds, the statute, if read literally, would suggest that if we ever sell parkland, the proceeds from the sale of that parkland have to be deposited back into the bond proceeds fund of the state. Now, we're not selling this land. It's being taken through condemnation. But what our request is, and that's the section on page 1, line 9, the reference to Minnesota statute section 116A695 is the provision that says that if you acquire land through using state bond proceeds that if the owner of the land then sells the land, you have to reimburse the state for the cost. Now, what we're asking the legislature to do is just to be clear about it, although an argument exists that this isn't a sale. What we're asking the legislature to do, in essence, is that whatever proceeds we get from this condemnation action, that the park board would be allowed to keep that, and on line 16 of the bill, we would create a parkland acquisition account that would be used solely to acquire land for park purposes adjacent to the Mississippi River in Minneapolis, that the land acquired from the account must be included in the Metro Regional Recreation Open Space System and subject to the same provisions of 16A, 695 that we're now seeking an exemption from. In other words, what we're trying to do is simply take these proceeds and replace the land taken that's going to be used by MnDOT to find other land in the riverfront and put it back into the regional system so that we can, you know, continue to further keeping that land in the river in Minneapolis as regional recreation open space.
Okay. Are there any questions about this? It's not in sale.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to doubly make sure all of this land was parkland, and it's not, none of it was private property.
That's correct.
And there isn't any money anywhere in the budget. It's just going back and forth. Representative Pilkey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Rice, is anything contemplated for change in this land that is being condemned and is now going to be owned by MnDOT? Is that actually going to change the character of the parcel in any way?
Madam Chair, Representative Hilty, it will change in this way. The deck of the bridge will be expanded and filled in. It will be a much wider span than exists there currently. They added a bus lane. So if you will, if you're underneath the bridge, it will, the roof or the expansion will be wider. There are some additional footings that are going to be put in here. The old bridge was a girder construction bridge, which we've all heard a lot about. This is a more, I would guess, like traditional construction. We will continue to have the parkway run underneath it. MnDOT has agreed to give us an easement. And if you look at the map very closely, you can see the parkway. It's looking underneath the bridge, you'll see it's a very narrow area. MnDOT will continue to give us an easement on that part of the roadway to run the roadway through there. But either side of it, it'll really be MnDOT land. I know that MnDOT, as part of the plans, are trying to make some amenities to it where people could actually walk further down to the river and overlook it. But it will not be planted probably in the same manner. And again, it'll be like any other MnDOT property. They have certain standards about what they want it to look like. They may perhaps fence around the footings so that they're secure and people can't, you know, access them and, you know, come close to them and, you know, do either mischief with them or just interfere with any of their operations. I imagine they'll be running utilities through there, electric, possibly water, things like that as it crosses the river. So I think the character will change just because of this new bridge design. It's going to be a much heavier weight with the concrete footings and foundations. So it will look different. That MnDOT, as I understand, I've seen some preliminary plans, are making an effort so that it is not your normal bridge. They're going to try to have some amenity features, but how that exactly fits in with MnDOT's plans and the park board plans is kind of two different.
Thank you.
Representative Horton. I'm thinking, Madam Chair, I'm wondering, does MnDOT oppose this still, or? No.
Madam Chair, we've had it introduced. They might have, I think we've tried to work very cooperatively with MnDOT on how it works. I think the issue, to be frank, with the committee is maybe what was financed into the bill. 16A, 695 is the finance section. MnDOT, as I understand it, is getting the bulk, if not all, of this money from the federal government to do the acquisition. So, and we've had a positive relationship with them. I mean, it's been very difficult in our park system. Representative Kahn is part of this district, but she's familiar with Bohemian Flats. And when you drop the mess that was 35W on that land in terms of the compaction of the soil, the shrubbery, the roads, I mean, it's a mess down there, and it's going to take some reconstruction efforts. And MnDOT has been very good about doing it, and we've you know, I think the park board for its part really expedited its effort. I mean, had we wanted to be obstructionist under the federal law, we could. There's obviously no interest in doing that given the tragedy and the need to have that road back up and running. So we're just hoping that the legislature, I would submit we were a good partner with the state, would allow us this exemption, if you will, or, you know, continue to keep that land on the riverfront and or some other land as replacement land. We generally have a policy of no net loss at the park board. If we were having land taken out of the system, we'd like to see it replaced elsewhere.
Representative Tulsi.
Madam Chair, Mr. Rice, has this proceeding gone so far as to have the amount of compensation determined at this point? And if so, what is it, or what are you contemplating?
Madam Chair, Representative Tulsi, for the downstream parcel, the MnDOT has offered $673,000 for that lighter shaded parcel. That's a fee taking, and then on the second page, which is just the easement area, it's a lighter thing and narrow, it's $43,000. So it's a total of $716,000. Oh, excuse me. No, that's the number, $716,000. As I understand it. And we are not contesting that. There has been a hearing. The court has not finalized the taking, but because of the unique provision in the charter of the city, the district court is required anytime any property is transferred out of the park system. It's much like a trust that you'd have if you had a trust that was being administered. Your trustee can't do anything without court approval. That's the way the parkland in Minneapolis works. In talking with the MnDOT attorneys, rather than have our board approve this action and then go to court and petition them to transfer it, I felt it made more sense for MnDOT to just bring in a condemnation proceeding, because there are other property owners, primarily Minnegasco, but there are some other property rights interests that need to be extinguished as part of this taking. It just made more sense to get it in a condemnation proceeding, have the judge, you know, determine it's fair and reasonable. We're not contesting it. We're not contesting this amount, and then the court can order title transfers through condemnation. It would work faster, would be more efficient for the state, and I think quicker all the way around.
Yeah. Okay. There's no further discussion. That House File 3723, I renew my motion that House File 3723 be passed on to the Finance Committee.
Okay. Now, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
There's a bill that we heard from Representative. Oh, I'm sorry. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passed. Sorry, I did all the amendments. That was enough to remember in one day. Okay. There's a bill of representatives. We'll get to you too, Mr. Bill. There's a bill of Representative Tilbury's, which we heard before. We heard with the Secretary of State. This is the Veterans Business Reinstatement Fee raise, and we heard it. We had Representative Tilbury with us, but we didn't really have the bill. So now we have the bill, and so we thought we'd do it symmetrically. We do it without Representative Tilbury. So I'll move the House File 3417 be passed and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. And we do need to put one amendment on. We need two. Okay, we have to move to amend it on page one. We have to delete line 20 and insert that section 1 is effective the day following final enactment, so it's not affected retroactively. Okay, move that amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passed. Okay, we'll pass it on, and we're holding on. We'll just pass this bill. I don't think this needs to be touched. Okay. There is. Little sister. Okay. The smallest number I've ever seen on a fiscal act. fiscal note, $1,000, something like that. Okay. So, all the, make the motion, renew my motion that it passes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes. Okay. So that still is on.
Chair.
What?
So since this has to go back to finance also.
Yeah, good. The motion was passed as a finance.
Oh, okay.
I think. Yes. Yep. The motion, make it clear, the motion was that it passes back to finance. Okay, we now have Representative Detmer is here. This is House File 2985 from Representative Detmer. I think for this motion, we're going to lay over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Detmer.
Yes.
Explain the bill.
I'm Representative Bob Detmer, and thank you, Madam Chairman and committee members. House File 2985 basically takes existing statute 471975 and just amends that statute. Basically what the current statute does, when a military person in the Army Reserve or National Guard is mobilized and is a teacher in a public school, when they return, if there's a difference in base pay, the school district will make up the difference. And that took effect in 2006. Basically, what my amendment does, if you look on page 3, line 3-6, what we're saying here that if requested to do so by a school district, the Adjutant General shall reimburse the school district for the portion of the payment under the paragraph B, not covered by the amount placed on special fund under the paragraph. So basically, we're just saying that the school districts can get reimbursed for the amount. And I'm open for questions.
Okay. I think we need to hear, we're going to have a little problem spending money this year, so we do need to hear from the Department of Military Affairs on this issue, on what the expected costs might be. I know we don't have a fiscal note yet.
Right, Madam Chair, they are working on that.
Okay.
Just to give you an example, in my own case, when I was mobilized, there was one teacher from my school district that was mobilized after 9/11 for a period of 20 months. So I'm not sure how many teachers we have that were mobilized during that time frame.
Okay. Mr. Palmer, can you come tell us? And I know we're waiting for a phone note, but
Madam Chair, Terry Palmer, I'm the Comptroller for the Department of Military Affairs.
Okay, Mr. Palmer, you have.
And I must tell you, Madam Chair, these are preliminary numbers. They've not been reviewed by the Department of Finance. So what I'm telling you is our best estimate of what the cost might be. We looked at the state of Minnesota's history relative to the provisions of statute allowing them to or making them pay the differential for deployed soldiers. In fiscal year 06, the costs were $526,000, just over that. And then in fiscal year 07, they were about $425,000. So if we extrapolated that out, it works up to about an average of $9.51 per employee. And that's the only way we could relate it to what we see in the Department of Education's numbers. So we went out to the Department of Education's website and found the number of employees that they show in the various school districts around the state. And they're reporting FTEs, so it's a little different, but it's about 107,000 total FTEs in the school districts around the state between administrative teachers, licensed and unlicensed employees. So if we take that $9.51 and multiply that out over the 106,909 employees, it comes out to about $1.1 million in the first year. And we would expect that number would decline in the out years, too, based on what we expect is happening with the deployment.
Madam Chair, could I ask a question?
Sure.
Now, those numbers are not the number of employees that are in the military, correct?
Madam Chair, we took the total number of employees. Because there's 50,000 state employees, we divided that, what the state paid out per employee, just because we had no other way to determine how many employees were actually in the military, in the school districts. But we thought that might be relatively the same for school districts and the state of Minnesota employees.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there a way to look at past history of school districts' finances and determine, the last 5 or 10 years of military personnel that was gone from the school district?
Madam Chair, Representative Ward, I talked to Education Minnesota, and they indicated that it's very difficult to get those numbers from the school districts. They have a hard time getting reports from the various school districts. So I suspect it's possible, but I don't know how you would go about getting those numbers from each of the school districts so you could compile a report based on the 107,000 employees that those districts have.
Why shouldn't we make the argument that it seems strange that military affairs should pay for this. Why shouldn't we make the argument that the Department of Education should pay for it? And I don't know if you've discussed that with anyone, that it is an educational expense, really.
Yes, Madam Chairman. I guess I would like to be able to look to see, in terms of my school district that I taught in, there was just one person that was mobilized. I can look at different districts. I mean, you might have one or two, and then you take a look at the number of districts in the state, even if it was just 5 members that were deployed. I mean, we're looking at a small number. We're not looking at the entire employee roster from every school district. We're just looking at small numbers.
It's also a small number for each school district, too. Okay. Is there any... Any questions? We will need to get a formal fiscal note. And I think we will need to have some discussion as to whether this would be a military affairs budget item or an education budget item.
Madam Chair, right now it's an unfunded mandate on our schools right now.
Yeah.
And I'm just wanted to bring that to the attention.
And Madam Chair, to that point, the Department of Military Affairs really has only...
a unfunded mandate on the Department of Military Affairs, which mainly has a federal budget and has a very small state budget. Is that okay?
Madam Chair, and I need to remind the committee members, too, that we only have a sight of what happens to the National Guard. We don't really have a good picture of what happens to the other reserve components. They're not part of the Adjutant General's purview.
It's not even clear. Is it clear that you could use your budget to pay reserve components? I mean, would that be illegal? We do have federal audit to all sorts of stuff with your budget. Would that be illegal expenditure?
I'm not sure.
Pass the
floor?
Yeah. And of course, we do have to make an additional appropriation to do. Okay. Well, this is one that we are holding over. So thank you very much, Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr.
Okay. Would you please pass? Okay, health. Representative Faust? Go ahead, Senator. Okay. House file 2645. This is one that we're also going to hold over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Faust?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. This is a really simple bill. This is asking for the National Guard to actually do a study on a program called the National Guard Youth Challenge Program. The National Guard Youth Challenge Program is being currently used, I believe, in about 30 states. And what it does is it gives students that generally have already dropped out of alternative programs and dropped out of school an opportunity to get back on track, basically. All this bill is asking the National Guard to do is to figure out how much it would cost to implement this program and where out of the possible locations it would make the most sense to actually have this type of a program. And with that, I'll turn it over to my other testifier who can explain the National Guard Challenge Program a little bit better.
Mr. Kerr. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Don Kerr, and I am the Principal Planner for the Department of Military Affairs and the Acting Director of Reintegration. And the agency's position is that we would be happy to study this and look at the alternatives as laid out in the bill and make a recommendation back, should that be the will of the legislature.
Okay.
If I can, ma'am, I would like to discuss the youth program a little bit more. Like I said, this is for students grades age 16 through 18 that have typically dropped out of high school already, usually even dropped out of the alternative programs that they're in school. This is not for students that have been sent there by a judge because they've done something wrong. It's a voluntary program, and the cost of this program is paid 60% by the federal government, 40% by the state government if it were implemented. And it has a very very high success rate. In the brochure that I think you got a relatively poor copy of, it talks about some of the success rates that they've had in other places. And so I think it's a very good program, and we're simply asking for a study to be done on it. We do have a fiscal note of about $18,000 on this, which surprised me it was that high, but it is what it is. And with that, I'll open it up for questions, I guess, or whatever you'd like to do.
Any questions? Representative Pratt. Okay, certainly. Looks like a good, you know, as you know, we're under all kinds of budget constraints, so at this point I just think we hold this over for possible inclusion in our bill when we put it together.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, we have a very tight timeline for the next bill, so I hope we can, no, we did hear this before. It was actually included in our omnibus bill at one point. At this point, it now comes back with zero fiscal instead. Representative Walker.
I will be very brief. Thank you for the opportunity to have this bill heard again. If you could have someone move the bill and move my amendment.
Okay. I'll move House File 219. We recommend this pass and go to Finance. And now I'll move Amendment 8, the A3 amendment, which obviously limits the scope significantly. And you want to explain the A3 amendment, or do you want to explain the whole bill? Do you want us to put the bill in the safe and then explain the whole bill?
I can explain it all at the same time.
Okay. So all those in favor of the A3 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Okay. Representative Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is my caregiver bill that you heard last year, that we were able to get it into the omnibus bill, like you said. Unfortunately, the fiscal note that you were had on it just was too high to accommodate last year. This amendment makes it a zero fiscal note. Right now, by law, an employer of more than 21 individuals, if you have a pure sick time, you can use that for yourself and your sick child, minor child. Wanting to make sure that if you have a pure sick time, that you can use it for the other loved ones in your life, your adult child, your partner, your mother, your grandparents. While we have these aging individuals in our society, especially baby boomers coming up, it is a cost-effective measure to be able to have a loved one be able to stay at home for a day or two to utilize that
appeared sick time instead of sending them to a nursing home or whatever that short day, or paying someone in adult daycare. Hopefully I can get the committee support today. I look forward to any questions that members may have.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize for just driving. Representative Walker, as I recall, House File 219, it attracted a great deal of concern last year from both the governor and from employers, both public and private. And my question is simply, is this the same bill, or have there been any changes during the interim to try and meet some of the concerns of the folks who expressed concerns last year?
Thank you, Madam. That's a wonderful question. As it relates to which part of the concern?
Madam Chair, thank you. And Representative Walker, for example, the definition of domestic partner, I recall there were some concerns that that it was rather loose in terms of determining exactly who is a domestic partner and who wasn't. That was one of the concerns, as I recall. And so maybe I could rephrase my question, Madam Chair, to help out. I know we're running short on time. Is this the same bill that was presented last session?
Madam Chair, yes, it is.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Comments?
Madam Chair, Representative Walker, I'm not sure. I thought at the beginning the author stated that there was some change being made to eliminate the fiscal note.
The change was made by taking the state out of it, so there's no cost to the state.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, okay. Did we move the amendment yet and adopt it?
Yes, we did. Okay. I think there's a comment from Dua.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Chad Tui, and I'm an assistant state negotiator and compensation manager for the Department of Employee Relations. We've had some discussions about the A3 amendment that you just passed, and previous to this amendment, as Representative Walker indicated, there was a substantive fiscal note to this bill. I believe it was around $10.5 million. While I think the language may leave some ambiguity in the A3 amendment, it's our understanding that with that amendment and the fiscal note backs this up, that the state is removed by virtue of having a policy and labor agreement in place that covers the sick leave use. So it's our understanding that with the amendment, because the state has a policy in place governing sick leave use, that we would not be subject We would not have a fiscal impact because of this bill. And that's why you see the zero.
Representative. Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if there's anybody available here to testify, but I'm just curious as what would the cost be for businesses in Minnesota to implement this plan? Representative Walker, I don't know if you've had an opportunity to speak to business leaders in the state of Minnesota, or if there's somebody from the Chamber of Commerce or to that effect that would be able to speak to that.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, no, I have not. You know, it depends on how you quantify cost. You know, it is a pure sick time. It's not new sick time. It's sick time that the employee has already got. You know, it's funny that, you know, while it's an expansion of the usage, the employee has already earned the right to utilize the sick time. I mean, we have employees that are already saying that they're sick themselves and going home to take care of their adult children or their mother or their spouse. Now we're just saying that instead of lying to your employer, let's just say that you're able to utilize the sick time the way that you're intending to use it. You can't use more sick time than you have. It's just the time that you've already been able to have while you're working.
Representative,
thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Walker. I mean, just like you said, if I, through the course of a year, accumulated 20 hours of sick time, I don't get additional sick time. It's just saying that now I can use that sick time for my stepchild or, which I don't have, some other family member. I agree with the author that it's just clarifying what you are now able to use. It isn't increasing the amount of hours. It isn't mandating people to give you more hours to do this. This is something that you approve.
Madam Chair.
Representative.
I see that there's a representative from the Chamber of Commerce, Mr. Diedrichs, and I was hoping that perhaps he could give us some comments on that, if he has an answer to that question that I had.
Thanks who you are. And
thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Dave Diedrichs with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and I apologize, Representative Anderson. Could you repeat your question, please?
But do you have any position on the bill?
Well, that's actually what I was just discussing, Madam
and
Chair.
And, Madam Chair, the cost as well, as what this cost
sure.
would be to.
Sure. As to the cost, no. I'm sorry, I don't have any information regarding that. And I was just discussing this amendment with some other members of ours, and to be honest, when this bill was introduced last year and in its form before amendments, that we were neutral on this bill, but I'm somewhat concerned by the language in the amendment in Section D that basically mandates employers to have new sick leave policies if they already don't have them. Our position at the Chamber is, and from information that we studied from the Society of Human Resource Management, is that 74% of employers already have some sort of policies in place to address these types of issues, which is why we did not oppose this language in the first place. But our position also states that we think it should be up to the employer to address, have sick leave policies in place to address the unique environment that each workplace has. And so now in Section D here in this amendment that does not allow for that, that basically says that employers have to have this type of language in place allowing for sick leave policies, causes some concern. But as to your question, Representative Anderson, as far as cost, I'm sorry, I don't have any of that information available.
Madam Chair.
I think we have a question that that's not what it does. Just Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Perhaps we can get at the heart of my question here. If Mr. Tui could come back to the table, and if you could maybe give us some information as to before this amendment that was put in place, how do we come to a conclusion that it would cost the state $10.4 million?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, what happens is the state guesstimates how many days of usage of sick time an employee will take. They guesstimate 3 more days of usage that each employee will take. Because they come and have their budget done every 2 years, the cost for them, they guesstimate, will be a $10 more million usage. What's not taken into account is the individuals that are lying and saying that they're homesick already and not at home sick. And so it's really just a guesstimate of 3 more days per state employee usage that they expect.
Madam Chair, it just strikes me that the interpretation that the Chamber has of the amendment may not be accurate, and I'm sure the author can speak to that better than I can, but the way that I understand the amendment is what it's just saying is that this section only applies where an employer doesn't already deal with this issue in their sick leave policy. It doesn't require that people who have who don't have a sick leave policy all of a sudden have one. It doesn't apply to employers who've already dealt with this issue on their own in a labor agreement specifically.
Okay, we did pass this before and did have it in our bill. So I don't know if there's any other. Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And perhaps Representative De La Forest addressed this issue, but I pulled up the governor's veto letter on the Omnibus State Government Finance Bill, which your bill was included as part of it. And in here, the governor cites this bill as one of the reasons why he vetoed that bill. Have you had conversations with the governor's office, and has the governor changed his mind on this issue at all?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, prior to session, advocacy groups had been trying to talk to the governor and work out some things. Right now, in the Senate language, is not there. I'm looking forward to more conversations with the administration to figure out how we go forward as it relates to a full vote on the House floor and then going into conference committee with the Senate. Okay. Yes. Okay, the motion for this bill is to pass it on to finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you. Meeting adjourned. Anything else to say?